sorry if anybody's going to play that later. So he moves across this wasteland. I mean, if you think of the way in which the landscape of South Africa was devised or designed under apartheid, you have the white town, and then you have the black townships which serve it on the outside. And they must be close enough, but also distanced in some way. There has to be some no man's land in between. And we see Tsotsi moving across that no man's land on a number of occasions. He takes the baby and he walks towards the high-rise towers of Hillbrow, which is in the old white Johannesburg, quote unquote. He has to walk across that land still hasn't been developed. This is a really important question which we can come back to and look at. The question in some sense is how would you democratize the landscape, the architecture of South Africa? We know that racism, official racism, has been ended in some sense. But how do you democratize a terrain which was built to encode and enshrine white domination? What's involved in this? It's quite clear, isn't it, that you can't simply just say, oh, now all people are equal. It's still the case that a majority of people live without electricity, without running water in some cases. What do you do with housing, with the space between houses, with the structure of roads, which run rather like Roman roads, run absolutely straight as military kinds of installations from white points to black points, but you can't go as a regular pedestrian from one to the other. That's not so easy. So we have those various examples. I suppose also there's the masculinity represented by Morris the beggar, and there's also perhaps that represented by Captain Smith himself, the white policeman, former Afrikaans policeman, fluent in Zulu and Xhosa here, because his beat, if you like, is Alexandra Township. Think about Tsotsi's own identity. We have the damage done to him, the fact that he's had to grow up living in these pipes. And we see that story quite early on, after he's beaten up Butcher. It's as though something in himself, at first we can't read it, can we, as he runs blindly in the night, having beaten up Butcher. All we've seen before is that implacable dead stare. Then he savagely beats Butcher, and then he runs. And we don't quite know how to run until his running is juxtaposed with images of this young boy who we can't initially place. So the cuts to this person that we learn, of course, later is Tsotsi David as a youth. But that the backstory is introduced only at that point, and it's striking that it's at that moment a woman's voice appears on the soundtrack musically for the first time. So we know of his life in Alexandra. We know of his involvement in Suki's Shabin. The drugs, drink, violence, the surrounding social context. And think of Zola's role, that is Zola the musician's role, playing as the crime lord, Fella, he's named in the film. And Fella, of course, refers is a name taken because of the great Nigerian Afrobeat singer Fela Kuti, very popular in South Africa. And so again this you see in the naming, the self-naming of this drug lord, we see him in fact looking outwards to a part of the continent associated with, for black South Africans, with strength, with self-determination, looking at Nigeria as that place. Fela's example comes up there. We see a number of references in the film to other moments of history or things which can be uncoded. One of my favorites is where Aap, an Afrikaans word meaning ape. So that large figure, his nickname is Ape. So Aap is in the house trying out wine, which obviously he's never tried out. The house of Dube, who they've broken into. great deal of menace. And he tries out the wine and he says, I don't like wine, I prefer beer. Zamalek, he says. You probably can hear enough to know that Zamalek is obviously not a South African word. It's actually, it's an Egyptian beer. And this beer becomes popular in South Africa. It's because of Egypt's winning of the Africa Cup of Nations football a couple of times in a row, once of which was played in South Africa. And so, again, an identification with an African superpower, in some sense, an African in which models of masculinity seem to be on display, which are not available inside South Africa itself. So you name your, you know, Zamalek is where this one particular club, is a famous club in football club in Egypt, is called Zamalek. The beer is named after that. So the question is asked concerning decency. I've taken a couple of stills here from one of the South African schools' pedagogical use of this film. So excuse the pedestrian nature of some of the questions. How far does Tsotsi change over the course of the film, etc.? But if we notice these particular events, all of which are significant events which jolt our relationship to him in some way. What is decency is the question that Boston asks after the murder of the man on the train. And do you even know, do you know how to spell the word? Do you know what it means? Linked to that question of what kind of a man would kick a dog, obviously. Tsotsi, in a sort of a scene that initially is quite hard place, then takes his baby, David, to the pipes. He explains, it's interesting the set of exchanges that occur there, because the children from the pipes come over challengingly to ask him, and he says, you see that pipe in the, I can't remember, upper right or whatever it was, used to be mine. So that sense of establishing, firstly, that he's from there in some sense, he's an alumnus of the pipes. But then bringing the stolen child to the pipes to explain to the child his own backstory, or what connection is he trying to establish in the scene? I think it's at these moments, from about this point in the film, that gaze, which earlier was absolutely unreadable, in a sense which just repelled our looking at it, begins to take on a different kind of aspect. It begins to be much more tortured, I think. If you look here, there's a kind of, there's a consternation, there's a kind of a pity. I'm not sure what words you would use to describe his look here. But certainly this is not that same absolutely inscrutable blank gaze of a murderer. It would seem something else is taking place. What he doesn't understand, I think one of the things about the film is that it's constantly showing us, in some ways, the limits of Tsotsi's own ability to process what he's seeing. Charges into Miriam's place and says, "Feed it, the child." And when she then unbuttons her blouse to do what he has demanded, he is confused. At first, of course, she is suspecting that he is there to rape her. Sexual violence is always present in the novel, but usually in the film, usually euphemized or alternatively just hinted at in some ways. But here, she suspects that he's going to rape her. But in fact, it's a kind of confusion. What he's thinking through, this doesn't seem to be his plan. What he's trying to process is the sense of his own erotic attraction towards her, but then that sense of her as a mother, which immediately triggers back in him his own memories of his own mother, his mother who has obviously died of AIDS at some point in the fairly distant past. So think of his confusion in front of Miriam. There's the combination there of maternalism and eroticism. He doesn't know where to look. He looks away at one point. It's as though it's I don't think it's her beauty that stuns him or that confuses him. It's more her the sense of her, he's thinking of her as a mother in some sense. So that it's as though for him the question of he can be what he is as long as the section of division of labor works as a division of labor, as long as he doesn't have to think of women in any kind of way. Think though of so there's her personal fearlessness. She's not she may be afraid of him, but she's protecting her child for the most part. It looks as though she is resignedly that as long as he doesn't harm her child, that's the only important thing for her, because she assumes he's going to rape her. But then think of the extraordinary confusion involved in the sorts of questions that he asks of her. The second time he goes round to the house, he gets there before she gets there, if you remember. And she arrives and he says to her, "Where have you been?" What a strange question for a murderer and rapist to ask of the victim, in some sense, that he is that he is using in this way. As though she is accountable to him in any way. It's a familiar question. Where have you been? It's the kinds of thing that a boyfriend says to a girlfriend. Where have you been? It's not something that is appropriate in this context. I also think of the one. Perhaps it's the next time that he goes to visit her. It's 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is. He knocks on the door, and she, of course, fearfully says, "Who is it?" And he says, "It's me." No identification, but again, the kind of thing that an intimate would say. It's me. You hear my voice, don't you? You know who it must be. But this is not, of course, what he is for her. Anyway, then that scene, either poignant or pathetic. I suppose it depends on you. When he knocks on at the end, when he says, "If he returns the child, can he come back to see her?" And the film, which then tries to stage her response, which she will not answer the question, but her look changes from one of a kind of blank incomprehension to one of, she gives perhaps the slightest of smiles. What is she thinking there? I would say it's unreadable. Even if she were to say yes, we wouldn't believe that that's what she thinks. It isn't as though a romantic encounter has occurred between these two, no matter what he might think about it. So look at a couple of those sequences. So again, it's the maternalism, eroticism that we're playing here. Now this is the sequence from the end where she looks rather... she looks perplexed, I would say, at the end. She's trying to register what he is to her. And there's one further scene which focuses on her as he's walking the baby to return it to Dubé. We cut to her sitting at her desk and basically thinking. And we ask the question of what does he mean to her? What has this experience meant, if anything, to her? Here he is again, trying to understand her. His initial way, of course, is he's a bull in a china shop. He charges into her into her apartment. He knocks things around, but then he's rather perplexed by these kind of what do they call those things that come down, the kinds of rattly things, wind chimes sorts of things. And he says, "Why is this one rusted?" And her response is so simple: "I was sad." When I made it. The second one, he says, "And this one, were you glad?" He has no vocabulary, he has no social vocabulary for these kinds of encounters. All that seems to have been cut out of his life. The film tends, by and large, as I said, to downplay or euphemize sexual violence by way of emphasizing either social fragmentation or class violence. The social fragmentation often is showed by the generic and not specifically gendered violence of the township, which we see frequently. Class in Tsotsi is worth thinking about. Think of the relationship between between Johannesburg as we see it. We see Johannesburg in two dominant aspects here. We see the house where the Dubés live, which is an upper class, upper middle class neighborhood, defined by luxury. The cars are sort of, you know, high spec cars, etc., etc. The roads are well kept, and so on. The gates around the house also are made of wrought iron, etc. This is an area of opulence, of plenty. The other look of Johannesburg we have is him on the hills, just on the outside, looking over towards Hillbrow. Hillbrow, the area of highest density in South Africa because of the high-rise buildings. It's a strange kind of area today. Still lower middle class dwellings, but also lots and lots of migrant workers from all over Africa living in Hillbrow. So, but its sense of density, again of a kind of danger, but not the same as the danger in the townships, but also a kind of glamour. That Hillbrow has, and he looks over towards us. In fact, in one of the more interesting sequences, he's looking out. We see the high rises of Hillbrow in the background, and there, in the sort of middle background, we see a group of uniformed black people who turn out to be the members of some Episcopalian church. There's a great deal of kind of redemptive, born again Christianity in South Africa in the post-apartheid period. It's all in some sense about the forms of the questions of redemption, which people are thinking through in their own ways. Obviously, truth and reconciliation at the elite levels. These church people, and then on the other hand, Tutsi's particular lone search in some ways. And I want to emphasize the search, which we see, particularly in the final sequence, we see the journey that he makes, both figurative and metaphorical. He moves from the township, he crosses over the bridges and the dirty, polluted waterways, and pollution is present all the time. He moves towards the elite areas in which he stands out, not only because he's wearing this shining white shirt, but suddenly we become aware of how small he is in the surroundings. He's dwarfed at this point by the middle class trappings, which he doesn't know how to deal with. He comes to the gate, and for a second time in the film, it's as though he's going to make a decision to leave without consequences. And when he first sees the baby in the car, that's his first gesture: leave it there, move. But then he walks six steps and stops. He does exactly the same thing in the final sequence, where he puts the baby outside the door and makes to move off. And then again, something stops him from doing that. What is that thing? Is that how the film answers the question of decency, I suppose? Does decency for Tsotsi mean accountability in some way? So think a bit about the final sequence. So this is here. He is looking over this famous building in Hillbrow itself, famous because recently it's been discovered to be structurally unsound. Its foundations are not as solid as they ought to be, but it's now populated by migrants from all over the continent. So here he is looking out towards the township. This is just a map with Johannesburg, so-called, in the middle. You see Soweto, a southwest township, in where you'd expect it to be southwest. Notice Alexandra in the north there. But the film rather it sets the township activity in Alexandra, but it places Alexandra as though it were in Soweto. So when Tsotsi moves across from the township, it's towards Hillbrow that he comes. If you actually left Alexandra and moved towards Johannesburg, you would have to move first of all through all of the very elite old white neighbors, and that's not what happens to Tsotsi. He comes first to Hillbrow. So again, the sense of from the class. How does the film represent South Africa. And I just a couple of points. Evidence of poverty and affluence, obviously. Evidence of mixed communities. Here the question is, why is there so little evidence of white people in the film? And very obviously, pollution, crime and violence, evidence of disease. We haven't focused on the as we come into the station, the huge signs advertising that HIV/AIDS is everybody's responsibility. In South Africa, about one in four or five of the adult population is infected with HIV/AIDS. The disease travels not through drug use or homosexual contact, but through heterosexual contact. This is the case all over Africa, in fact. But the situation made very much worse by the former President Thabo Mbeki, who, for reasons known only to himself, decided to make what he called an Afrocentric point about Western medical pills and so on and so forth by declaring that that they didn't work, but that various forms of traditional African healing could solve the problem of HIV/AIDS. It set back the cause of combating AIDS by about two decades, I would say. And Mandela, for his part, was very much opposed to Mbeki, but Mandela had already moved away. So let's just look at the concluding scene. I probably won't play the whole sequence. It's just actually, I'm going to jump even further forward for time reasons. Sorry, go back. Here he is walking away.
Din. Sesudah nak. Gewisser und dann aber am Ohm.
So a couple of things. As the just think about the semiotics of the presentation. This boy is going nowhere, he says, but then addresses him as brother. What you hear are the forms of social relationship being coded, of firstly of patriarchal authority. This boy is going nowhere. He positions him as a boy, as someone who is, in a sense, is incapable of representing himself almost. But then speaks to him as brother. So brother to brother in that sense, can they make a connection? Think of the significance of that gate as it opens, because it takes a long time to open. It rattles past John Dubé's face for about 3 or 4 seconds. And what are we seeing there? Are we seeing Tsotsi being brought closer to Dubé in some ways? Are we seeing, is that divide the divide of class? Is it a divide of opportunity? How do we understand that sense of the link between them? And then that scene, that question is compounded for us. Because Tsotsi is on the one side of the white line in the road. The road is cambered, as Johannesburg roads are steeply divided like that. And Dubé walks across. And you wonder if he's going to, just for reasons of symmetry in some sense, is he going to stand about the same place on the other side of the white line? But he doesn't. He walks right up to and over the line to take the child. That sense of this is his world. He isn't, as it were, behind lines, and so on. And then the final sequence, I suppose, which addresses is that sense of raise your hands above your head in a gesture of surrender, which of course he does. And that's many endings were experimented with in the film. You can ask Owen about these. He studied the endings, I think, of the film. But the should he be killed at the end? Should, you know, etc. They chose this one eventually for various sorts of reasons. But I'm thinking of how do you interpret that final that final look? I mean, let's just look at a couple of those. Here he is walking towards here. This is the white line in the centre, and Dubé moves right up to and over that line. But then that's the final gesture. How does one interpret that? Is this a submission to the norms, to the protocols of the new society? I mean, what exactly is involved for Tsotsi here? I mean, many years in prison, etc. But is this a gesture of an entry into citizenship? Is that what's happening? He's moving from an outlaw to an in-law. In a sense here, from outside of the law to somebody who is governed by the law, inside the law, which is how we understand the question of citizenship, I think. Then two more moments I think must be focused on, and you can look at the literature on this, particularly look at Rita Barnard's essay if you're interested, because Rita dislikes this film. She thinks it's manipulative and so on, and she particularly focuses on the way in which the music manipulates us. I can't read it that way, partly because I'm sort of indescribably moved by that soaring female voice when it comes up. The if you think of the two moments at the end, the baby handover soundtrack, just very quickly, this is no image, but just the music. Think of the gendering, the music, obviously, the woman's voice carries this. Then, having heard that, what we hear as the credits are rolling is a return to Zola's track Bambata, which is a kwaito, in other words, a township rap track. And the crucial point about it here is that as the credits are rolling, Bambata was a Zulu prince. Who in 1906 opposed English, the English army, and was overcome, with tremendous loss of life. So the sense of but has entered into the Zulu and therefore into the South African pantheon as one of the first resistors of white oppression, of white domination. So the sense of, at the end of the track, as the credits are rolling, Tsotsi has surrendered, but then suddenly this kwaito track, again back to a masculine notion, the kwaito track phrase, and what is it, it makes us feel good, it's a great track, but what work does it do ideologically? We've just had the woman's voice, etc., we've had Tsotsi surrender, a defeat which is also not a defeat. It's a defeat, but also some sense of a rejoining on Tsotsi's case. But then we go back to this this quieter track, and Barnard argues that in some ways the film wants to have it both ways. It wants us to understand the sober lessons of citizenship, but it wants us to kind of thrill also in the outlaw motifs, which seem to be opened up by the Bambata track. So that's how you leave the theatre with that playing, and the sense of have we gone back to the beginning? What has happened in that journey? I think that's the question in some sense that's open for us. Barnard answers it quite cynically. As I say, she feels the film is quite manipulative and it's quite ideologically retrograde. My own reading is that it doesn't. That's not what happens. But I do recognise the force of her argument. So over to you then. I'll see you in seminar.